My name is Janice Goodman, and I kind of hesitate a little because I have a lot of names. But my name is Janice Goodman, and this tape is going to be titled Making Room for the Dance. Yesterday I talked about beginning the spiral dance, and the first step is making room, making a big enough space, and that will be my title today, the title of this tape. I'm going to be doing about 15 tapes, and maybe every day I'll give you a little other dimension of who I am. Today I want to tell you that I am Nusukya Ayat. That is my Indian name, and I have recently been given it. It is a Coast Salish name, and it means the silver salmon woman. And the silver salmon woman, I have been told in my naming ceremony, was the first salmon that led the salmon people back in the spring. And they came back up the rivers in the spring to feed those people, those Coast Salish peoples. And on the occasion of the first salmon appearing in the river and the first salmon being caught, the tribes have a celebration, a ceremony, a sacred ceremony, the first salmon ceremony. And they take the whole first salmon and they cut it up so that everyone, all the people, have some of this first salmon. And they take great care to eat this in a very sacred way, offering thanks for the gift of the salmon, the gift of life. The silver salmon brings life to all the people. And they take great care to return to the waters every bone of the silver salmon, the first salmon, so that that might recreate or regenerate the next year's return of the silver salmon. I consider that name to be tremendous responsibility. It has been an awesome experience, and I have a lot more to tell about that story sometimes. Maybe you'll hear it. But that is another one of my titles. Could we stand and pray together? I'm not going to turn to the six directions this time. I'm going to pray a prayer that's based on what Matthew Fox calls the Via Negativa. He says that that which is silence and pain and sorrow is a spiritual pathway. And so my pain, my prayer is going to be lifted up out of that today. Creator, we stand here together, a small circle of insignificant human beings, a tiny group, and there is a sense of our weakness in the struggle to affirm the lives of others and to protect our sacred Mother Earth and to discover our own giftedness. We stand somehow alone in our lives. People whirling around us, but seldom really knowing and experiencing the whole of who we are. We stand here with a vast, empty place, a place of pain sometimes, of grieving, of loss, of disappearing. Let these be a place for us of beginning. Creator, let us be silent so that we can hear the music that you send our way. Let us be empty and open so that we can be filled with the spirit that you send our way. Let us admit our weakness so that we can experience your strength. Let us name our darkness so that you can bring light into our lives. Is there anybody here who wasn't here yesterday? Can you come in and join us in the circle? Okay, good. Welcome. I'm going through a process right now of transition. In my process of getting educated, I have a master's degree in Indian education. In order to do that and go to school and get the grades and everything, I learned to sort of compartmentalize myself. I would be one person and I would agree to a system out there that I marched through in order to accomplish a task of getting a degree. And that was about 10 years ago. I finished my master's. And about 2 years ago, I went back to begin a doctorate. And I had changed and grown. And I was much less able to compartmentalize myself. Yesterday when I was speaking, I was doing some things that were not linear. Introduction, middle, conclusion, this follows this, follows this, follows this. And I was taught to, you know, be like that, be real organized so that your listeners can really understand. And in reaching out to you on the subject of American Indians, I've tried to get in touch with my own way. And about right in the middle of my teaching yesterday, this panic came up over me. Oh no, I'm not being organized and linear, and I'm not being faithful to my text. And I just sat here for a second and just sort of fought this panic down. But it's very important for me to continue the struggle to do this in a way that is coming up from the inside of me instead of my taking myself and sort of plastering myself up to a form that isn't me. And so I invite your compassionate acceptance of my struggle to communicate. I'm translating into back and forth, and I'm in between. And that's just sort of a little statement. I've invited you to begin a spiral dance with me, to take a journey. Yesterday I talked about climbing on the back of an eagle. And we climbed on the back of an eagle, and we began to soar in a sort of really high way, looking at the whole scope and expanse of a story. And we talked about rushing out, making a beginning, however clumsy, however difficult, but beginning and going out and looking around. And then we talked about the ability of an eagle to see one little tiny thing moving and zoom down and focus on it. And so this experience for me of talking to you is a little bit of a dance. And it's more of a butterfly kind of experience of just touching down and yet lifting up. I understand this is not necessarily easy to do or to follow, and I apologize for any feelings of confusion that might lift up in you. I don't want you to be uncomfortable, but I want to try this. Okay, so we're going to get on the back of an eagle and we're going to take off, and we're going to touch down occasionally and zero in and zoom in, and we're going to soar out and across space and touch down in different places, and we're going to come back in and connect it to ourselves here in this group. So it's going to be a kind of emotion. You might feel seasick when we're all done. Okay, so we're going to clear out the space here a minute. The subject today is the Pueblos, and basically I want to just, for those who weren't here yesterday, we sort of flew back in time and looked at the reality that there were indigenous peoples who have been given names like Anasazi and Mongolian and Hohokam and Hopewell and Mississippi and Adena cultures, but there were living cultures of people all over the ecology of this land. Ancient times, before Egypt and Mesopotamia, and they were civilizations. They were towns. They were farming. They were peoples who were doing more than living, but they were also experiencing themselves as part of a whole universe, a whole cosmos. And we tried to get a handle on who they were, and we looked at the leadership of some of the people in this country who do that sort of thing, the archaeologists. When I went to bed last night, I realized there was a couple things I wanted to say about that. I heard myself talk about the graves. So this eagle is going to kind of zoom down on one little thought for a minute. If somebody from the future was trying to understand us, and so they dug up the graveyards that we have to see what was buried with us, to see the position that we're buried in, the way the bodies are prepared for burial, the places of burial. Would they get a real good understanding of us? This is a really good book. But it has, I think, a little bit of trouble, because when we're exploring some of those earliest times, we don't have anybody there to interpret for us. And the only evidence that they have to tell us about the Hopewell or the Mississippian or the effigy mound peoples are the graves and the preparations and the burial of the dead and the pottery pieces and the stone arrowheads. I just wanted to share with you that there is a sense there for me that we're just getting this little tiny glimpse of what was. And because it comes out of a grave exploration, it may not have that ability to celebrate the life. It may not be life-filled in its understanding and interpretation. So I just lift that up to you as something that I was thinking about. Another thing that I wanted to say is I have a little trouble with people digging up graves, as they do now, archaeologists. If you want to be an advocate of Indian people, I hope you hear that. Digging up graves is something that still is going on, still is an issue, still is a problem. I don't know how we get the knowledge, but if we are going to dig up graves, I think we should understand what a sacred experience that is. There's a lot of grave digging up that goes on not only here but all over the world that does not protect the sacredness of the graves. Okay, that's a little zoom down and we'll fly up again now. I invited a couple people to share, and I want you to be ready to tell me your name and what your associations are, images that are coming up about Indians. I'm kind of going to stop and do that every once in a while as we swirl out and do that, and we'll come back in and get personal and then kind of go out. Okay? Pueblos. We're going to get on this eagle now and go soaring over this beautiful land of ours, away off of this mountain, across the plateau, across the Colombian, down the Rockies, and get down there into the southwest United States. Is there anybody here who is from the southwest? From Pueblo country? Nobody born in Arizona, New Mexico? Any of that? Anybody live there? Phoenix? Albuquerque? Anybody made a study of the Pueblo people? Anybody know a Pueblo person? Okay. Okay. What does Pueblo mean? Does anybody have a sense of that? What is Pueblo?
Isn't that a house?
I think so. I don't know. Does anybody speak Spanish? I think it's Pueblo means house, the house people. Yesterday I talked about the Anasazi, and I said that in this book he said that trace the roots of the different of some of these ancient tribes continue, that these ancient groups of people did not vanish or disappear or are not non-existent. And one of the things that he said is that the current Hopi people are somehow inheritors of the heritage of the Anasazi. And when I talk about pueblos, and I talked yesterday about names, so now I'm going to roll out some names. And I think this is a sacred thing to say their names. We're talking about like the Oraibi. I wish I had someone from down there because I don't have these in my ears. Walpi, the Zuni people, the Acoma Pueblo, the Jemez Pueblo, the Cochita. I want you to kind of listen. There's a language coming through here. Santo Domingo, Isleta, San Juan, San Ildefonso, the Santa Fe Pueblo, the Taos Pueblo, the Picuras Pueblo, the Nambe Pueblo, and the Pecos Pueblo. You hear the Spanish coming through here. When we talk about the Pueblos, we talk about Spanish. Why do we talk about Spanish? We talk about Spanish because some of the first people who went to experience that land down there were Spanish. And so they came up from their experiences in Mexico and the Mayan. And that's really important. And I'm not going to try to talk about that very much, except for to lift up to your memory the history of the Mayan and Aztec people at the hands of the early Spanish explorers, the things that had happened down there prior to those same peoples coming up into our Southwest. Just to refresh our memories, the Spanish came looking for gold. They had a mindset. They wanted gold, wealth, minerals. And that was their whole orientation. And the experience of the peoples down there in the interaction with the Spanish turned out to be very destructive of those early civilizations, early peoples. A lot of killing going on. I'm not going to get into it any more than that. The spiral dance. Seeing a pueblo, a town peoples in our own Southwest. People who built houses. Have you seen the pueblo designed made out of sort of like a mud plaster and little windows? Some of them have no windows, and they're like apartment houses. I think that there is a pueblo. There was at the time of the I don't remember numbers very well, so I'm going to look it up. There was at the time of the beginning. Where is that? The first interaction between the Spanish and the Pueblos, there was a town, I think, that had about 38,000. You know, talk about apartment dwelling and city life and all that. I mean, there was a lot of people there. Do you know what that looks like down there? A desert, kind of a desert. The Grand Canyon there. There are these red sandstone cliffs. It's dry. It's really hot. I think Phoenix now is about, 120 right now? So you can see the sensibility of thick, mud-walled apartment houses. And, you know, if you get the wall thick enough, it can stay cool inside. Can be protected from the sun. And you can get a sense of the difficulty in feeding. Gosh, 38,000 people. How do they feed all those people? And so then you can see that there was some irrigation, some farming. You had to get pretty organized, don't you think, to feed 38,000 people or 10,000 people or 15,000 people in one small area, relatively small area, in a desert. Had to have some kind of government, some kind of organization. That's the Southwest people. Just the practical living of being out there in that area, that's the people we're talking about. I'm just going to let you meditate on that experience while we get more specific for a minute. We're just going to soar, having looked at it, we're going to talk about ourselves for just a minute. Give me about 1 minute on who you are and what your name is and where you come from. We'll get about five people and then we'll go soaring again. Anybody? Want to be first?
Go ahead. I'm Bea Bratley and I live in Anchorage, Alaska. We went up there in 63, time for the earthquake, which was quite an experience. And like my friend said, we're often asked the question why we go to Alaska, and she says the most common answer is my husband likes to hunt and fish, and I guess that's sort of why we went there. It was an adventure, but it lasted, and I still live there.
So you have experience with Alaska Native peoples, Indian, Eskimo, Aleut, or?
Yes, mm-hmm. And in the Indians, it's the Athabascan, the Haida, the Tlingit, and I don't know if there's some more.
Tsimshian.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking too that when we worked in my class, in that Northwest Lit class, when they came in and taught us the different their different crafts, I mentioned yesterday that this one Indian taught the class how to carve masks. We didn't get too far on it, but and then the ladies taught beadwork. I thought of that yesterday when I saw your lovely necklace. Beadwork, and the Eskimo ladies taught skin sewing.
That's
another thing about the Eskimos that we did. We had a unit on Eskimos long ago, and they made their own seal lamps, and that was the only light they had and the only heat they had. And so we had the art teacher come in, and she helped us make seal oil lamps, and we each fashioned and designed our own, and then she gave us each a wick, and they worked. They burned, and it was kind of fun to make that connection with long ago.
Interesting. Thank you. Anybody else want to tell their name?
I'm Sonia Hernes from the western part of North Dakota, and I've been in the Dakotas most of my life, both north and south. We have reservations in our area, and I guess I really don't, there aren't any in our community, or any Indian people, and our biggest connection is the schools we play basketball with.
Mm-hmm.
And
good. Thank you. Go ahead.
I'm Agnes Johnson, and I was born in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, but my parents, my father and mother were the first. I just found myself when my brother passed away in December in his obituary. My father and mother were the first missionaries to the Rosebud Reservation in South Dakota. And they were there for a couple of years. My aunt, my father's sister, went out and taught school. And of course, we had many stories, my mother telling about the Indians coming up to the door. She was a young bride and was afraid. But they'd stand and look in the window, and then she'd get out some food, and they'd come in and eat, and not say a word, just quietly eat and go on, not bother anyone. And of course, one of the great things in our life as children, we learned to count in the Sioux language, and of course, that's still very vivid in my memory, and a lot of words for different things. And but my folks were just out there about 3 years, but we've always heard very favorable and beautiful things about the Indians. And my younger sister always said she was an Indian, and of course she'd always want to wear a red band around her head and things like that. So we felt kind of a relationship to them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Maybe one more? Tell us your name.
I'm Glenn Collins. I'm in the Navy. I live and work in San Diego, but I call Spokane home. I haven't got much experience with Native Americans other than what was in high school, which was unfortunately little, in all the history of Washington and quite a bit that kind of lore type stuff. But I don't really work with any Native Americans that I know of. Don't have too much experience in the area.
Thank you. Well, you ready? Get yourself settled. Let's go on a little bit. Let's go back. I. What gift can you get from learning today about the Pueblo, or from hearing and seeing an Indian person yesterday? We talked about some of the images that you might have had. here's someone who has talked about a gift. And here's another one who's talked about the experience. What gift could you get from learning about the Pueblos? As we take off again and head down there, and I think go back a little bit in the past, and what we see is whole groups of people living with a system, a worldview, a way of centering themselves that worked for them. We see people of abundance, people with a sense of order and stability. They had a lot of energy, and they had some sacred ways, some tactics of hanging themselves together. Each town was independent, sort of self-sustaining, and they didn't cooperate a lot with other towns, with other places. They had relatively tranquil lives. They had an agricultural economy. They had fields, and they raised the three sacred plants. And remember that I said sacred, that the food is considered sacred: corn, beans, and squash. In fact, corn mother is a concept that comes out of the Southwest, the concept of creator is corn mother. We see people who were related to each other in the ways of women, in that their associations were based on the mother, the ownership lines, and the, when you got married, you lived near your mother. And it's kind of a matriarchal. It was a different culture, certainly, than the Spanish coming in. We have people who have this very strange idea to people who don't come from there, that the individual life is not that important, but that what's important is the individual contribution to community life. That the people who have a concept of shunning outstanding individualism. Outstanding individualism is not considered appropriate to the life of the apartment dwelling Pueblo people. There's a couple of interesting things here. Witchcraft and self-assertive non-conformity were almost, in their view of things, synonymous and both crimes. Witchcraft. And right on the same level as witchcraft, self-assertive nonconformity. A nonconformist might have been considered a witch. They considered anybody who was a braggart or a malcontent, anybody who had a sense of pride or jealousy, were potentially dangerous, just as dangerous as someone who was, you know, had a contagious illness, or someone who could cause earthquakes. And interesting. It was a strong cultural repression of individualism. Now that's different from some things that we might have experienced. So they govern themselves by a kind of voluntary society. And I want to read something about that. there were these life-sustaining activities that kept the whole system going, right? You know, all the different kinds of possibilities that there are. And it says, those who perpetuated life-sustaining activities by joining these voluntary societies were the ones who really accepted full human responsibility. Put that in the context of Holden, you know. Only those who are joining in are accepting full human responsibility. And it's interesting here, the connotation. They were considered, quote, cooked, unquote. While any adult who did not join in the society, this voluntary supporting society, was considered, quote, raw, unquote, delinquent in the activities expected of them. Isn't that interesting? I think that's really, really neat. How do you join a society? You just say, I'm going to join, and maybe you get an initiation or a ritual washing. Here it says a symbolic whipping. I wonder what that means. Other things that were important required some indoctrination, some learning, some apprenticeship. And women had their own societies. Sometimes women joined in the male societies, and sometimes they had their own. But the societies are the ones that presided over the essential activities. And the societies learned how to do that from a group of, this is a hard word to translate, and they use the word deity. And maybe the word is teacher or creator, maybe it's artisan in our context here. I don't know how to translate it really well, but maybe it's the rich Khmer or something, I don't know. The Kachinas. The Kachinas. Have you ever seen a Kachina?
Kachina doll.
Kachina doll. Has anybody ever seen a Kachina dance? They have a concept of these people, these not people, but spirit beings that come every year and teach each different society how to do the thing that they do to keep the whole community right. And the Kachina doll is a representation of a Kachina ritual, an experience of this sacred being coming and teaching these voluntary societies how to keep life going.
In the dance, didn't they wear Kachina masks?
If you've seen a Kachina doll, it's very beautiful, colored, shaped, fascinating, artistically,
very
incredible. And they have a sense of that not being a human being, but a spirit being, a Kachina. I have another spirit being in a third society, and I can't say the words. They have K-O-S-S-A, Kasa, or K-W-I-R-E-N-A, and I've never heard it, so I don't know what it is, or K-O-S-H-A-R-E, and they could be considered to be clowns, the clown society, that had a very important role, which was sort of the, you know, who we would call almost the clown society in our society. Anybody want to guess?
The comics.
The what?
The comedy people, the comics.
Not necessarily in this context, although we do have, well, yes, we do, of course, have the comics. But, yeah, that's true. There's another group, though.
Cartoonists.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, caricatures and things like that.
What is that context again?
The Clown Society. Mm-hmm. That had a serious purpose. Well, let me read the rest of the sentence and you'll get it. The Clown Society used buffoonery as a means of public ridicule to shame potentially troublesome citizens into accepting community standards. Boy, we could have a whole session on that. They served as the local police force. And that's the group that I was saying. It's kind of almost a police force dealing with social deviance to ensure the smooth operation of village life. Isn't that fascinating? A connection between clowns and comedy and laughter and police. Wow. I just love this. It's fascinating to me. Think about the policing role of comedy in our society. We have various voluntary societies and sacred beings, the Kachina teaching the work, coming out and sacred rituals. Don't you want to go home and learn more about the Pueblos? We've soared out there now. Let's think about that a minute. And meet each other just a little bit more. How about four more people? Tell us your name and where you're from. Go ahead.
I'm Betty Johansson, and I'm from Pullman, Washington. And unfortunately, I don't have a lot of knowledge about humans, but there are several groupings, I think, in that area that have been asked first. I'm sure, and I think the Blues were a separate tribe. And there's several words that are used. You know, that like Palouse itself, I think, is grassland. Potlatch, which is a town, I believe, is the Indian name for gift, for a special description of it. And part of the, I believe, if I'm correct, the Nez Perce were the ones who helped Lewis and Clark in their journey through part of that area, especially the area near Lewiston, Idaho. Yeah, that's Lewiston and Clarkston right together. There's a mount, oh, not a mountain exactly, but it's called a butte, and it's named for Kamiakan, a Yakima chieftain. And then one of the largest groups that I know of that are Native Americans in that area are into Idaho, near Kenya and Kuski, and they have a number of, you know, concerns which would go back to the time of their own history, when they were a clan or a tribe right there, and like their rights of the fishing, which has changed so dramatically because of all the bans and this, and the run of the salmon. And there's a great deal of, I mean, I realize some of this is really sacred to the peoples. And, so there's a great amount of conflict, or at least legislation, between these people and the government, you know, as to what would be their rights to the original treaty obligations. So it's very interesting. I'm sorry that I can't share, you know, more, but I don't.
Yeah. Good. Thank you. Go ahead.
I'm Jill Hartle. I'm from Kashmir, and I don't know much about Indians myself or no association much, but we have the Chelan Kami Museum at Kashmir, which is supposed to be the outstanding Indian artifact museum in the state of Washington. We have a doctor, former doctor from Wenatchee, that collected all these Indian artifacts along the Columbia River before the dams were put in. And he has outstanding things. The whole upper part of the museum is all Indian artifacts. And he, of course, is particularly interested in looking, digging up skulls to see the injuries medically, you know, what had happened.
Because he was a doctor?
Yes.
Hmm, isn't that fascinating?
I have another lady, Marie Keast, over here that might be able to tell you a little bit about it. She works there too as a volunteer.
Uh-huh.
Well, I think you've done the part that I would consider most interesting to the people,
mm-hmm.
the part about the Indians.
Well, we have children that come from all over the country around here to see the museum.
Uh-huh.
And they're working, they have some that isn't out for the public to see it yet, because
mm-hmm.
we don't have the cases and all that are not built to put them in.
If anybody has time to stop in, if you ever have time.
And mm-hmm. the tribe of Indians, the Malachi,
mm-hmm.
that was the tribe that lived around there.
Mm-hmm.
If you ever want to see Arrowhead, you need to come to that museum.
Yeah.
They're beautiful.
Yeah. How about one more? Thank you for sharing.
I'm Midge Collins, and I'm from Spokane, which is an adulteration of the Indian name given by a group of the, I believe, the Nez Perce Indians who settled in that area, which is beautiful, the Spokane people, which meant the children of the sun.
Beautiful. Thank you. Okay, shall we go again to the, how interesting it is to begin to explore who are our Indian brothers and sisters who live near us. And if we don't know that yet, what a wonderful door that is there beckoning to us. And how much fun it can be and really enjoyable and a gift. And while you've been listening, you also somewhere in your mind and heart have been meditating on them, these Pueblo people.
Do you have any pictures of their homes, you know, the way they were built? Do you have any?
No, I'm not in that orientation at this point. Oh yes, there's just so many. Interesting. There's a lot of stuff out there. You know, just go into the library and look up Pueblo.
Are you in the library?
Oh, I think maybe you can find some here, yes. Or Arizona. Down in the southwest of the United States, we have a people's home beckoning to us to come and learn and understand. And we see evidence of those people all over the United States, in fact, all over the world. You see pottery, some of the pottery. Maria of San Ildefonso is just breathtaking pottery. I told you that's a desert area, and you have these colored sands, and we have the concept here of sand and cornmeal laid out in a particular way. And what they did is they laid out a pathway for the spirit, for God to walk. They invited relationship and contact with what they needed from what was not human, what was God. And in order to make it hospitable, they would take sand and create a sacred way, a place of contact between that spirit. And it's interesting, I'm going like this because I'm Lakota, and we tend to reach up, but the Pueblo people with the sand. See, the Pueblo, sacred room in the Pueblo is the Kiva, which is down. And then down in the center, I mean, the Kiva has, it's circular like this and has benches along the outside. And then in the center is a pit. And if you ever get an opportunity to hear any stories, creation stories of the Pueblo people, they tell stories about the three levels of life. And they believe that the Pueblo people came up out of the ground. They came up out of the earth in a particular place. And so in their sacred ceremonies, they believe that they came up out of the earth. And so then when you use the sand, you use the earth, and you make a hospitable place. That's really interesting. You make a pot. Next time you think of a Pueblo pottery, and you see these beautiful painted and shaped pots, incredible craftspeople taking little coils of clay and shaping it into this incredibly smooth and perfect symmetrical shape. And you think about this kiva, this well in the center of the earth where the people came up out of. This is a sacred thing, to own a pot from down there. It's really a sacred thing.
What was the name of the potter that you...
Maria of San Ildefonso. She's...
And where is she from?
Michelangelo of Southwestern Pottery.
Where is she from?
San Ildefonso Pueblo. People, we see these Pueblo people dancing, celebrating. Incredible dancing. We see people who live in a sacred way. I would like to go down there and live with them for a while. Some of you may have that experience. They had this strong life. Now, we don't have too much longer, but what will happen to them? What experience will it be for them to be greeted by the Spanish? First coming through looking for the city of gold. And this is, remember, the Roman Church, Roman Catholic, Jesuit, and Franciscan, the system of monks, mission churches, the friars coming through after the explorers. Here comes another thing, another culture. What will happen as these two cultures come into contact and then conflict? And how do we begin that story? We begin that story with the first people who came through, the explorers, who were later followed by the missionaries. But you know, there's an interesting part of that story that some people aren't aware of. After the explorers, and almost before the missionaries, something else came through. Anybody know what that is?
Disease.
Yeah, we talk about the bubonic plague and what that was like. Well, diseases. The European diseases came through. The smallpox, chickenpox, measles. Here we have these vigorous lives, these incredible systems. And then came the disease. And estimates are that half, some places 3/4 of all the people died in that first rush of diseases. Imagine what they were trying to do with that. They had their life. Here came the Spanish explorers. They heard about what was happening, and the death Imagine the stories of death coming out of the Mayan and Aztec. They heard about the death down there. Don't you think? There were travelers and people. They heard about this destruction, this killing going on. They knew death was down there. And then it started to come through. And it didn't come through in the form of people and soldiers and violence and armies first. It was preceded by illness. Isn't that interesting? I'm kind of overwhelmed. I guess that's why I started with the via negativa today. Some people don't understand why. Why did the Indian people allow these people to come in and just take over and destroy? Why did the Pueblos not get rid of them all? And I was just pondering on that, you know, at times. Just think what it was like to have a system, a lifestyle, a setup, everything worked out, and then have this death come through. Make that connection maybe with our prayer this morning. What is the relationship between God and evil? Why does God let death happen? Thinking about that. I'm kind of running out of time, and I want to invite you at some point in your life to open yourself up to the stories about these first conflicts, these first experiences. And I started out today with a sense of saying that there's pain. I invite you to not deny the history of the original indigenous peoples in this land. To not deny the pain that is part of our history. And to not deny your own pain when you read about your Christian heritage having a part in that pain, having a major role. Because that's reality. That's the reality of where we are as peoples living in the same house. You know, it's almost like child abuse or husband abuse or wife abuse or elder abuse or even incest. That we have a situation in our house in the United States where we have people in the same family who hurt each other. And I invite you to be open to that as a reality, as a pain. It's real hard for me to sit here and tell you the story about what happened after the Spanish missionaries came to these beautiful people. The destruction and death that came as a result of the movement of the church, the European church, to save these people. It's a real painful story to tell, and I'll tell it gently if I can. It's painful because it's a story of betrayal of our faith. A faith that teaches us, a scripture that teaches us, love your neighbor and yet in the name of that same religion, people were experiencing a tremendous death and destruction. And I want to tell that story in the context of, as we talked about flying in an eagle, flying on the back of an eagle, as we go back and we look at the truth and the reality of those experiences between the Spanish and the Pueblo, that we also come back around to where we are today, where we have most of those Pueblo people who exist today are Christian, and most of those people also are still in touch with their traditional heritage. So it's also a story that in the beginning talks about pain and destruction, but becomes in fact creative and transforming as you carry that story on the back of an eagle through time and space to today. Some of the gentlest and most beautiful people that I know are Pueblo. And I invite you in your life journey to learn more about them and their culture and their language and their history and their needs. And if you can, I invite you to become an advocate of those people so that their lives can continue, their languages can be preserved, and that they can continue to live as parts of our family, brothers and sisters. We didn't have time to introduce everybody else, and we might want to do that afterwards. And you might want to bring up some questions. And so I want to stop by inviting you to come back again tomorrow at the same time, and we'll pick up the story of the Huron people in the northeastern part of the United States and their experiences with the French missionaries a little bit of a different experience and a different people. My purpose is to teach you that Indian is a tremendous, diverse, and varied group with an incredible and interesting and important history, which is your own history as Americans. And to invite you to stay with me as long as you can on this journey, and to continue this journey, this spiral dance, wherever you go from here. Find the people who are there, the native original indigenous people, and experience them. They're still alive. They still have much to give. I think you will be deeply blessed by learning to love them, as I do.